KevinKennyRadio.com. You know who he is. Flea is in the house. Thank you for stopping by.
Thank you for having me, kind sir.
And it's kind of funny, I think. You're not here to really talk about music, although that does play a role in this bad boy. Acid for the Children is out and available everywhere now. And the man to my side is the author of this fine book.
Yeah.
How does it feel to be an author?
I like it. It was kind of terrifying from beginning to end. The idea of, like, one, failing, just not being a good writer. Two, making myself super vulnerable and, you know, sharing parts of myself that I wouldn't normally share. And three, just coming to terms with myself and getting underneath the narrative of the things that happened and, like, my own journey of self-discovery, which is always hard,
right?
You know, to really learn about yourself.
When you're an artist that is as successful as you, when you're in that rarefied, you know, conversation that you and your band are, as a creative, do you try to seek out failure? Because you're in a position with the Chili Peppers where it's impossible to fail at this point.
Well, no, it's possible to fail. Like, for me, if we were to just go cashing in, making money, playing the old catalog, not at least trying to grow and doing our best to grow and innovate and explore new territory, that would be a failure to me. Like, for me, curiosity and innovation and discovering new things is everything.
Right.
And I'm always like, and not just like music, obviously, is a huge part of my life, but I'm always looking to do different musical projects. I'm always looking to challenge myself in anything, whether it's like learning to become a good chess player or getting my jump shot together or running a marathon or, you know, being a good dog owner. Like,
yeah,
we just talked about, whatever it is, like, I'm always, you know, I'm always failing.
Well, there had to be something, as intimidating as it may have been, it also had to be exhilarating too, right? Because you're going into this endeavor and you don't know if you're going to succeed or fail. I think there has to be an element of when you do a new album with the band, you know you can do an album. You don't know how good the album's going to be, but you know you can do it.
Well, you have to try.
Try.
Yeah.
You must not have even known if you could finish a book, no?
I knew that I could finish. I knew two things. I knew I had to be honest, and I knew I had to write every word by myself. And, you know, but I love books so much. I grew up loving literature since I was a little kid, even when I was an absolute out-of-control guy on a slippery slope out in the street, like getting into trouble, crime, drugs, like just all the bad stuff. I was an unwatched, wild street kid. I always read,
yeah,
you know, and I've always loved books, and they've always been a guiding light for me. So when I embarked on this journey of writing one, I just wanted to contribute to literature. It was important to me. Like, I knew I could write a book and it would say Flea and Chili Peppers fans would buy it, you know? But if for me to write a book that could exist on its own without, you know, any rock stardom fan stuff, that could just be a book that 100 years from now someone could read and be like, wow, this is an insight into a time. And, you know, like when I read books from the 1600s, 1700s. So, I knew that I could fail in trying to do that, making a piece of literature, but I knew that I had to do everything I could to make the most earnest attempt at that.
I kind of love how much it's not about the Chili Peppers. It ends shortly after the first show there in 1983.
Yeah, well, kind of ends at the first show.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. It's not about the Chili Peppers because it's about my childhood leading up to it, but to me, that's more about the Chili Peppers than anything I could have written, really. Because once the band starts, like, we have our thing. We have the guys. We have the energy that brought us together. And then a lot of crazy things happen. And, yes, there is a whole other story that entails, like, a lot of emotional, spiritual, physical dynamics to it. But everything leading up to it is the stuff that really created it. You know, like, our friendship, me and Anthony's friendship, me and Anthony Hillel's friendship, me and Anthony Hillel and Jack's friendship, all of us coming together and the forces that brought us together and all our yearning to understand and make sense of the world and, you know, all the, you know, and I can't speak for those guys, but for myself, like all the loneliness, confusion, frustrations, feeling of hurt, and all the triumphs and the joys and the hope and the desire to, like, connect and love and bond with my friends, like, those things were so intense. And those are really the things that made the band be the band,
right?
You know?
When you look back on your life, and you must look at it through such a different lens now, having written the book, how prevalent or top of mind is the idea of duality? Because that's what was the prevailing takeaway from what I've read in here, whether it be the relationship with Anthony, whether it be your relationship with Walter, whether it be even Walter, your memories with Walter, and then your memories with your own mother, the sense of duality.
Absolutely. I'm glad that you picked up on that. The more that, like as I grow, you know, and I have my spiritual practice and all the things I do in my life to be as conscious as I can, it becomes more that the idea of duality of lightness and darkness, you know, night and day, good and evil, all of those things being in such equal proportion to each other that you don't have joy without sadness. You don't, like you were asking before about failure, you don't, you have to fail to have success. And you can't enjoy success if you don't have failure. You know, like these things all have to go together. And, you know, whether it's like the microcosm, you mentioned Walter, and for people that don't know, that's my stepfather, Walter, who was the most present father figure in my life. And, you know, he was a brilliant musician, but he was also a junkie and a disaster and a very difficult, scary person to be around. And so while I learned the lessons of one, like music is incredible, two, you can take all your demons and all your tortured energy and all your pain and put it into music, and it could be the most remarkable alchemy that's like healthy for the world, because people get to enjoy something good and for yourself. Like I learned those valuable lessons from him. He was also like scary and mean and explosive and violent and made my house an unsafe place to be. So, you know, just that little thing right there, which obviously, you know, for me is a big thing, but in the scheme of the world, you know, it's a little thing, but that's kind of a microcosm of this universal truth. And it's kind of the thing, like, you know, I'm not a religious man, but I believe in God. And, you know, I pray every morning, every night when I eat. You know, I have a spiritual practice. I meditate and stuff. And for me, like, the most perfect display of, like, my idea of God, of God's, like, divine energy breathing through everything is that light and dark, is that, you know, you inhale, you exhale, like, just everything, and it's so perfect, like, karma, like, every act that you do that causes harm, that much harm comes to you, you know, and you learn by these things, and, you know, I'm 57 now, and my life, like, is, you know, as difficult as it's been in some ways, as joyful as it's been in others, is a cakewalk compared to a lot of people. I could have been a child soldier when I was 7 years old and, you know, in war-torn Sudan. You know what I mean? There's so many realities that people have, but always that duality is just, like, it's wild.
I mean, if I can take you back to a really poignant moment in this story that you gave
Sorry
us.
Sorry for going off my crazy
tangents. This is exactly what I want to talk about with you, is that probably the most tender or meaningful moment I'd have to imagine or among them with Walter is happens when he's actually inebriated. He's drunk and he's talking to you and he's telling you how special you are and the light inside you and how you're really going to do big things in this world. What is that like though, when even in that moment as a kid, because you're dealing with a drunk parental figure, but then they're bestowing such high praise to you?
Yeah, it's a wild moment that you picked out. And of course, like, each thing that I write about is kind of symbolic of a pattern of events that happened, you know. And in that particular moment, we, you know, we had this basement and we had it kind of, it was like a, you know, this basement where we hung out. And I walked down there one day to, like, I don't know, get my book or do something. And he was sitting down there, like, with a bottle of vodka in his hand, kind of crying and drunk. And he embraced me and started speaking to me about, like, you know, I could tell that he was really feeling the pain of the world, of just existing as a human being. And he was feeling this deep sadness. And I don't even know what it was that was getting him down that particular day. But he started, like, telling me how much he believed in me and what a beautiful kid I was and how much, you know, he just held me up as this kind of paragon of virtue, of this to tell me anything's possible. You're always going to rise above. You're always going to share your light. You're always going to be this beautiful thing. And it felt so good, like it was so kind and sweet. But at the same time, even though I was a little kid, I must have been like 8 years old or something, I didn't know what it was to be drunk or what any of that was. But I knew it was a mess. It was coming from a mess. And as much as I embraced it, I could feel the unsteadiness and the all the pathos behind it. You know what I mean? So it's like I'm embracing it, but I'm also kind of scared of it, because I'm kind of scared of him. I love him, and I'm appreciating the love. But I also feel this volatility and this, you know, really unstable thing, you know, where it's coming from. And that's another, you know, encapsulation of that duality, you know. And in his particular case, it was kind of, especially when I look back on it with some degree of objectivity, because, you know, my childhood is a long time ago, which is another reason why I kept the book about my childhood, so I could have some degree of objectivity. but it's, you know, another thing about that duality, you know? And I think, like, everything, like, what drives me in my life, like, I'm partly driven by the fact that I love art, and it means everything to me to express the light and everything, all the joy I see in the world and all the pain, and turn it to something beautiful. But I'm also, because I never really had a stable parental figure growing up, I'm also, you know, there's a part of me when I look at myself that's yearning to, like, please love me, I'm all right, you know what I mean? Like, if I make this really good music, will you think I'm an okay human being?
To this day.
Yeah, it's always a part of me. I mean, I'm conscious of it now, and I'm way better. You know what I mean? Like, I love myself, and I have people in my life. I just got married. I have beautiful kids. I'm really grateful to have all the love I have in my life.
So when was the first time in your life? It's not, sorry to interrupt you.
No.
But when is the, if you look back at your journey, when's the first time in your life that you can point to a moment where you felt love and acceptance without a caveat, right?
You know, oh, man. Well, you know, I've been loved many times. People that love me, you know, I had, you know, different relationships with women who loved me. I've had friends who really, really loved me. But I think it really, like, if you can't love yourself,
right,
you can't really accept trust love. Like, I think you trust love in equal proportion to the amount that you can love yourself. And I, you know, I'm always working on loving myself. And sometimes I can, sometimes I can't. It's always been a struggle for me.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, but I've been really lucky to have a lot of love in my life. And, you know, yeah.
The duality with in regards to your friendship and relationship with Anthony, I totally hear you 1,000% on the need for duality, you know, the rainy days to appreciate the sunshine. But there are some stories in here that you're very open about, a camping trip when you guys were kids, where it almost borders on cruelty. And really, it boils down to, and I think you very eloquently explained in the book, your sort of need for stable support and Anthony's need for stable control, and why that sort of friction, in a, you know, for better or worse, works for you guys. Do you ever feel like you could have had maybe more of the sunshine with less of the rain with Anthony? Like, do you really think that you needed that much duality?
Anthony and I have had plenty of sunshine. You know, I wrote that story because it was something that shaped me, and it was an early part of my life. And sometimes in talking about it, maybe I should have written more about just the joy and love and all the creative stuff that we've shared, because we've just had a fantastic friendship and relationship. And it's been difficult. We're both very intense people, and we butt heads. And, you know, he's someone that I trust and love. And, you know, within, you hurt the people you love sometimes. And, you know, I'm sure that I have been a complete asshole to him and judgmental many a time when I didn't need to be. You know what I mean? And I might not even be conscious about it because I was too bullheaded and pigheaded to see what I was doing. So, I can't, you know, that's my comment on that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What I thought was so interesting, you were telling CBS that you and Anthony can sit down in a room and talk about something, and you'll both have a different idea of what happened in that room.
Totally.
And what struck me about that is that I talk to so many artists, and they say you need good rapport to make great music. You need to be on the same page. How do you guys channel sort of that, like, maybe language barrier, for lack of a better term, into just phenomenal music?
Well, thank you. I don't really agree with that, about you have to be on the same page to make good music. I think that, obviously, you have to be able to work together, but you have to... Like, if I wanted to be in band with everyone that thought like me and did what I wanted, then I might as well just do it by myself.
Right.
You know what I mean? I think likewise for anyone in my band or anyone. Like, what makes it really difficult is that we disagree all the time and we fight and we hurt each other's feelings and we, you know what I mean? And, like, I don't like your idea, or that sounds old-fashioned to me, or why are you forcing it to try to be something else? You know what I mean? Like, the fact that we all come with a different idea and bring a different thing is the thing that makes the band work. You know, that, like, we all have this different thing, so we all bring something completely different. And it's, you know, having the, like, hopefully having the togetherness as friends and trust to bring all those things together and to realize that each person has a different worldview and a different creative expression and bring them together, like, that's what makes it. And at our best, like, the best shit we've ever done, we're fighting like cats and dogs and disagreeing, you know what I mean? But ultimately respecting, you know, what everyone was bringing and knowing that it's unique to who they are. You know, and that's not, you know, not always fighting like cats and dogs. Right. But definitely, you know, I can't count the times I walked out of a rehearsal room sulking, my feelings hurt. You know what I mean? It's just part of the creative process. And I think for a band to be great, everyone's got to bring something different to the table.
What Chili Peppers album or song comes to mind that was the most creatively contentious?
Oh, God. I don't know.
Nothing?
I really
look
can't
back
think.
At the...
It's more like an overall process.
Yeah.
You know?
Do albums blur together for you, personally?
No, they all have a distinct feeling and a time, and but that's really difficult for me to say, to pinpoint it to a particular song or anything like that.
But you can almost hear it in the music in a really beautiful way. Like, it almost sounds like, I can think of Chili Pepper songs that like sound like a proverbial mosh pit. You know, because you think about the pit, it's like a place of community. It's a place where all these things work together.
Yeah.
There's collisions, and there's all these
different
things colliding.
Yeah, it's things colliding, and you know, I just think successful collaborations come from people who are willing to go up against other people too. And you know, look, we all, you know, you get in a band, it gets successful. Everyone gets a rock star ego, and that's not healthy. So sometimes you need your bandmates to challenge you. You know what I mean? Where it's like, you might go out and play something. I might go out and like have a night where I know I'm not playing that well. Like I might be tired, or I'm distracted, and afterwards people come to me, "Oh my God, this was the amazing thing I ever saw. You're so incredible." It's like, thank you, but you know, I can do better, you know? And sometimes you need your bandmates to, even though, you know, you want to be considerate and supportive of your bandmates, you need someone to disagree with your idea.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. You compared this, actually, you did a really cool, it's online if you want to check it out, a live stream interview at a book signing, I think just a day ago here in New York.
Yeah, yesterday
It was fantastic. It's like 40 minutes of just you really opening up about it. And you were kind of comparing the process of writing this book to putting out an album, and how an album-making process is so private. You make a project with your friends, you know, there's not many people in that room, and then you give it away to the audience on release day, and it becomes, or it can become, this other thing.
It always becomes
a different thing.
Yeah.
I'll go back to
like
the...
Like, you don't own it anymore.
Well, right. And the identity of it is different. And so, can you think of... I'm going to go back to the catalog here and test your memory, but can you think of a Chili Peppers album that sticks out as, wow, that means something so different to us than what the public identity became of that work?
All of them. I mean... I can't really specifically think of one. I remember when... You know, when John Frusciante, he had left the band after we made the Blood Sugar record and toured. And then, you know, we made another record with Dave Navarro. Then when he came back again for Californication, we had this real feeling of rebirth, you know. Mm. And it was like everything was firing on all cylinders. You know, we're all in love with each other. We're in love with the process. And yes, we had our disagreements and we all brought something different to the table. But I just remember it being like, you know, we're in my garage, you know, sitting there, you know, writing every day and playing and putting it together and growing and learning. And then, you know, all of a sudden the day, you know, we turn it over to the record company, it comes out. And I remember just being so thrilled, you know, at the idea of it. Wow, people are hearing this. And this is something that you know, was obviously so personal and private to us. And as soon as it went out, it was like all of a sudden I'm reading all the critics, you know, that are saying stuff, and mostly supportive, sometimes not. I remember like sitting in a restaurant. I was here in New York, and we were doing a press tour, and these two guys were sitting in another booth, and they were like kind of like cool rock dudes, you know, probably played in like underground bands or whatever. And I heard the one guy saying to the other, you know, Chili Peppers are pretty lame, but man, you know, sometimes I hear the records and it's kind of good. Like, it was almost like it was a guilty pleasure to like us, you know, like it wouldn't be cool.
Because you'd gotten so big, you think?
Yeah, probably because we were big, or for whatever reason, you know. I understand, you know, whatever reason, you know, he didn't want to like admit that he liked us, but he's telling your friend, but you know, they can really, you know, they can play, they put a fucking song together, you know, and I hear the other guy going, oh, I don't know, but I could tell he kind of liked it too. And it's just like this idea of it being a thing, like it goes out there into the world and takes a, like you said, a new identity, but it's... I can't really put one over the other, but I have these memories, you know, and it's just like from when I was a kid, and like the first time I just like I write a little story in the book, the first time with my first band, and we made a demo tape and it got played on this radio station in LA, and was going to be there. It was like some like new band night, you know, and some, and they play like, you know, 50 songs by bands that no one's ever heard of. And we're sitting there in my friend's room, like, you know, smoking weed and listening, and like one bad song after the next. And finally they get to our song, you know, it was called Clocks. And the DJ, I'll never forget it, he goes, and here's a neat little ditty from a band called Anthem. It's called Clocks. You know, and we're sitting there, we're like, hey, can't believe it. And they're playing it, and we're jumping around the room, like going crazy and, you know, laughing. A neat little ditty, a neat little ditty. And it's that moment, you know, it's like that thing, like other people are hearing this. And it went from being this just like intangible thought of us playing together to this thing that you can pick it up and you can hold it and you hear it and you think different things. And my point was, when I was doing the book talk last night, was with the book, man, it's more intense, you know, it's way more intense. It's like this thing of I don't even know how to say it. Like, it's music has always been a vulnerable personal thing to me, but in something that is literally about my childhood and my life and my growing process as a kid, and like I said, I was vulnerable and honest. It's that times a million. You know what I mean? It's like all of a sudden, yeah, it's this thing you can hold, and people look at it, and we talk about it, and they're all gonna read it, and they're all gonna have different ideas about whether they like me or don't like me, or think it's a good book or a boring book, or whatever they think. But it's just a wild feeling, man. From something that's so personal, just me by myself, quietly in my room, writing, to, you know, here it is, world.
Well, it's a diary. It's the closest thing we're going to get to your diary, your journal.
And now
the world can read it.
Yeah, and I wrote it like a journal. You know, I pretty much wrote the whole thing with a pen to paper. You know, then I would take that and put it into a computer and organize it and find, you know, with the help of an editor, learned how to, like, you know, organize things,
mm-hmm.
yeah, cohesively.
I wanted to get your thoughts on something really quick that touch on in here, and it's that you and Anthony kind of felt like outcasts growing up, and I think of the origins of the term alternative music, and I think to make alternative art of any kind, don't even make it music, alternative art, you sort of have to feel like the other. You have to feel like you're on the outside looking in, so to speak. And, you know, of course, like, all genres evolve, and I think alternative means something very different than it did maybe 30 years ago. Do you look around, if you keep up with popular music these days or any kind of music these days, do you look around and see that outsider spirit in anyone or any particular sound or genre today?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, whenever I see any young person, like, dedicating themselves to art and really having the diligence to give their whole spirit into it, like, so many people, like, we're touring on our last record with this guy, Thundercat, who's just an amazing musician, you know, and I see him, like, and it's just, he just popped into my head, you know,
yeah.
So many people, but when I see him, I know that the way his mind works, it moves at such a fast pace, and he's such a, you know, like, intellectual, obtuse kind of person, and, you know, I see him, like, the way that he fostered all that talent and turned it into this incredible ability to make music, that comes from being a part, you know? And you have to go your own way to be an artist, you know, to express your true self. It means really being willing to embrace your, not do what anyone else is doing.
Yeah.
You know, you might be things that you love and zeitgeist and things that move you, but, you know, you have to let your nervous system express itself in its way. And I, you know, I can only speak for myself in terms of, I grew up and I never really felt connected to like a kind of a group consciousness. And I know that it was difficult and painful for me, but also did help me to define myself as a musician and, you know, in my life.
Yeah. I'm going to ask you one final question, just to wrap things up, because we are unfortunately out of time. And this is, I'll almost use this as a tease for if you write the second book.
Okay.
You know, because I love how this ends really at the start of the band. I was having a conversation with Adam Duritz of the Counting Crows last week,
yeah,
about, you know, they have that song Mr. Jones, and how getting back to the identity of bands and legacy, and how your band's identity or legacy, right, to the public can be so different than your, how you view the band. What is, if you had to pick a song that you guys have made throughout your career, what is, like, I don't want to say the number one, but what is, like, what is the song that encapsulates the Red Hot Chili Peppers to you? Because the public, you know, the critical mass, they might say Under the Bridge, right? They might say Californication, but
yeah,
to you, what is it?
Man, it's so hard for me to answer. no matter what we do, we're never going to, like, we can do anything. We could be the most poignant, poetic band on earth, and people are always going to be like, oh, the guys with the socks on their cocks. You know what I mean?
Right.
But I don't know. I guess, you know, in terms of sentiment and in terms of, you know, rhythm and feeling, Give It Away has always been a song for me that, you know, no matter how many millions of times we play it, every time we get to the end of it and we're closing out a show and me and Anthony are, we're all like, you know, vibrating and jumping up and down, everything is alive. The idea of giving it away is just such a beautiful thing, you know? And so for the sake of trying to make this a good interview, I'll say that one. But every song is a different facet of who we are, and it's such a hard question for me to do, and kind of impossible.
Yeah, well, you're a sport for trying to answer that. Thanks so much. And again, for you watching at home, Acid for the Children, out and available everywhere now.